Thank you very much. Wonderful. Thank you very much, Brother Joe. Good singing, great services today. But when I was standing right there, maybe we should close that door. I'm telling you, the aroma of what's back there can be distracting. And you are closer to it than I am. With this, I'm thinking about the conversation my wife and I we had at lunch. And she said, you know, she said, honey, with my where I am in life, and she is much younger than I am, she said, you know, I have to change my diet. And I look at her, you know, thinking, uh-oh. She said, you know, I want to have more frequent but smaller portions. And I said, well, that's a pretty good idea, but at my age, I have to have a transition. So why don't I begin with the frequent part of it? And if it works out, then I will change the smaller portion part of it later. I think that's a great idea, don't you think? You know, we can start with the frequent part very quickly, you know. And a few years later, 5-10 years, if it works out, then we could go to the smaller portion part. Don't you? Nobody says amen. Oh, come on. I thought you guys were with me with this. Oh, here you go. Yeah, I love you, brother. All right. We are in Job 38, and we'll finish one part of it. On a more serious tone this week, my wife and I met with a gentleman whose life had been a succession of tragic incidents that left him traumatized and for cause. From his childhood to his adulthood, it has been one tragedy after another. He witnessed terrible atrocities as a child, terrible things that no child should be exposed to. His father died in unknown and presumably cruel manner. His sister was criminally assaulted, leaving her with partial handicapped. His mother barely survived a terrible car hit that left her brain damaged and physically impaired. Finally, he is suffering from trauma that have ended his college education and also his aspiration to become a pastor. And on top of it all, he has been falsely accused of crimes that could have put him in prison for a long, long time. And I look at this man and I say, no human being could listen to this man's story and not be touched. If you have a heart, you look at this man and you say, man, that's tough. That's a lot for a person to bear. But with wet eyes and a defeating voice, he said to my wife and me, I have read the Bible from Genesis to Revelation many, many times, and I cannot see why God is doing this to me. And he said, I am beginning to lose faith. He said exactly what God sees as the issue when suffering strikes. Suffering is a trial or testing of faith. We know God is capable, and I think we're at the next slide, yet we are baffled that God is not willing. We ask why, and that's how we feel. And humanly speaking, this feeling may be understandable, yet it is still misconceived. Despite the depth of one's suffering, it is a misconceived notion to think that God is capable and somehow not willing or not caring. Job had that conception. And God challenged it. God challenged both Job's conception about God and Job's contention against God. The way that God showed that his beloved servant Job was misconceived in his notion is through two speeches or discourses. In the first speech, God asks questions to show his sovereignty in regard to the macrocosmic matters of the world's operation. We will return to that slide if it's going to go fast. But the second speech, in that second speech, God asks questions pertaining to microcosmic matters of the world. Those two words, macrocosm and microcosm, sounds like big words, but they are really simple. The word macrocosm refers to the aspects of God's governance over the universe overall. It relates to the whole creation as a system. It speaks of the whole globe, the big groups of species, you know, the big things, the big companies, you could say, you know, the Fortune 100 ones, you know, of the world. So the big stuff. The word micro, small, microcosmic, you know, those things, the word microcosm refers to the individual, the small parts of the world, the insect, one animal, one individual, us, things of the like. So whether in the big picture of the world's operation or in the small individual parts, God operates the world wisely. He operates the world flawlessly. He operates the world punctually. He operates the world purposefully. He operates the world justly. He operates the world perfectly. And that's the point he's making from those two speeches. Now let's return to that first speech because that's what we've been studying. The first speech contains two main parts. After the sandwich of the challenging of Job at the beginning and challenging of Job at the end, the two main parts, they are questions about the origin of the world and questions about the operation of the world. In regard to the origin of the world, in verses 4 through 12, 4 to 11 of chapter 38, God is asking questions of where were you? God made this world out of his loving, smart, and responsible initiative. Job was not there to judge. He was not there to supervise. He was not there to advise. He was not there to inspire. So where were you? Even at point of reality in the life of Job in existence, Job could not advise or conceive something better or otherworldly, something that God has not invented. Can you? Can you conceive something, another creation, that is dissimilar to this one? Are you that creative? Anything that you think we think about is within what God has already done. So where were you? Can you conceptualize a system or something that he has not made and say, I'm going to create this that God has not made? We are bound within this that God has done. That's the origin of the world. But when it comes to the operation of the world, God asks questions pertaining to who are you? Questions like, do you know? Or can you do? In the operation of the world quiz, this is what the Lord is stating in that speech. So on June 12, we studied the macro, big, remember? The macrocosm of God's sovereignty birth as it applied to the inanimate world. Verse 12 to 38 of chapter 38. There we saw elements of the world that are seen, but that human beings cannot penetrate. God controls all that perfectly. We saw dynamics that influence movements in the world, but human beings cannot see those things that are happening, and then we see the result, but we don't know where does it come from. God knows everything, and He controls that. The phenomena in the cosmos, God does them. The phenomena in meteorology, the changing of seasons and times, God does that. So all these operations, all these phenomena, God has invented them, and they are not smarter than God. He controls them. God has operated them for millennia. God has never failed in operating them accurately, punctually, and purposefully. Yeah, Job thinks that the way that God is operating his life is out of whack. No, God does not make mistakes. God has never made mistakes. And God will never make mistakes in the operation of the inanimate world. We ended our study on June 12 by asking ourselves this question. How do inanimate things hear and obey anyhow? I mean, that's a marvel to itself that someone can talk to that piece of wood using the same language, that same sound, same tone. Not only did Christ like the disciples, they marveled. Not only did Christ have the ability to speak to the wind and the sea, that is phenomenal in itself, but the most striking thing, they obey. Who are you? Not only do you speak the same language that everybody uses, you used it. They listen to you, they don't listen to me. And not only can they understand what you are talking to them about, they obey. That is a point. God controls the inanimate world. They know Him. They respect Him. They recognize Him. I mean, can you imagine this? And when you do, how do you feel about telling God that, I don't think you know what you are doing in the way you are conducting the affairs of my life? But this evening, we have to wonder that if God can speak to the inanimate world and that they obey Him, what about the animate world? They seem to have a will of their own. That is what God speaks about in chapter 38, verse 39 through chapter 39, verse 30. And that is what we will study this evening. The macrocosm of God's sovereignty in the animate world. This section contains 12 animals. As one commentator broke it down, 6 beasts, 5 birds, and 1 insect. And when you look at this section, though God has selected these 12 animals to include in His speech, what He is saying does not apply only or exclusively to those animals. As one form of speech that we have seen and have repeated and explained very often, and this is a synecdoche where you use parts to speak about the whole. So those single animals, they represent the whole animal kingdom in the aspects in which God is speaking. So instead of speaking of these animals for themselves, we will speak of them as we speak of them this evening. We speak of them as representative of all other animals who look like them and who have the same traits. The first, there are six groups here that God has done, and I will have you read those passages and we will speak at them. The first group is in verses 39 to 41 of chapter 38. And we have a couple of them, the lions and their cubs, and the ravens. And we do have a microphone there. With my permission, you can read, and you can only read chapter 38. It's a joke. I give her, she's shy, and I give her the microphone. She said, oh, I have a microphone. And I said, you are going to read when I tell you to read and what I tell you to read. As if she is any time out of line. Never. Go ahead, Kimberly, please. Read verses 39 to 41 for us of Job chapter 38.
Can you hunt the prey for the lion or satisfy the appetite of the young lions? When they crouch in their dens and lie in wait in their lair, who prepares for the raven its nourishment when its young cry to God and wander about without food?
So God is sovereign and man is unable to feed the animals of the world. Lions and their cubs, they are ferocious and fearless predators. They go after their food mercilessly. Animals that are much bigger than they are. Ravens are on the opposite scale. They live on the refuses of the earth. Carcasses, foodstuff that human beings have left unguarded. And from the top of the feeding line to the bottom of the food chain, God feeds all animals in the system. And he has established that system. It is not Job. Job does not do that, nor can he. And God does it faithfully and needs not someone to tell him how or when to do it. Oh, it's time for the elephants to eat. Oh, I forget. What am I going to feed the elephants? God initiated the whole thing. In verse 39, we see that though the lions and the cubs are ferocious predators at the top of the food chain, it is God who provides them with the opportunity and the ability to hunt. Not Job. Not man. Not you and I. We followed God's providence, the lions can do nothing. And God does not fail the lions. We see in verse 40 that God provides for lions and their cubs even when they are resting. They do not produce their own food. They don't cook it. Or prepare it, or go get it to the groceries and pay for it. They are resting, and when it's time to eat, they just go out there and find it. Who provides that? They just go out and get it? God produces that food for them, not Job, not man, not you and I. You look at verse 41, the ravens are even less capable than the lions. At least, like the lions, they do not produce their own food. But unlike the lions, they do not even hunt their own food. They don't even fight for it. They eat the refuse, the leftovers, and the unguarded food of the earth. Their little ones can go longer hungry than the lion cubs. Yet, God, in his providence, feeds them. They live in an unfavorable system at the bottom of the feed line. God takes care of them nonetheless. They may suffer for a little while, but God takes care of them all the while. Do you know that very often in talking about his care for his people, God compares it not to what the lions do, even though the lions are dependent upon him, but to what he does with the ravens. He says this in Psalm 147, verse 9. He gives to the beast its food and to the young ravens that cry. And the Lord Jesus Christ himself encourages us this way in Luke chapter 12, verse 24. He says, consider, as we are doing this evening, examine, look at them to learn something. Consider the ravens, for they neither sow nor reap. And I kept telling my wife, that's a good way to live. They neither sow nor reap, which have neither storehouse nor barn, and God feeds them. Of how much more value are you than birds? And God continues in verses 1 to 4 of chapter 39 to talk about his sovereignty in setting the birth cycle of the animate world, but the inability of man, of Job, of you and me to do the same. Let's read chapter 39, verses 1 to 4, please.
Do you know when the mountain goats give birth? Do you observe the calving of the does? Can you number the months that they fulfill? And do you know the time when they give birth, when they crouch, bring forth their offspring, and are delivered of their young? Their young ones become strong. They grow up in the open. They go out and do not return to them.
So two more animals are mentioned here, the wild goats and the deer. The wild goat here may be a special kind called the ibex, and that can hardly be spotted by human beings. I mean, they do hide wild in the mountains. And it is said in science that people do not see how they reproduce. I mean, just see them having kids. They never see how or when. These animals, deer and the wild ox, they represent here all the other animals, their gestation and birth cycles. Think about it. No midwife. No ultrasound. No nothing, if you can accept my English. Yet they, their gestation periods and their birth cycles continue without any supervision, without any help, without understanding, any understanding from Job, from man, or from you and me. All from and by God. And Job cannot keep an exact register of their medical files for each of them. Can you go, gee, there are about 50,000 elephants. And Job says, I have number one, number two, that's the medical, number five, number 2,500. And now let's talk about the mosquitoes. Mosquito number one, Yeah. So God keeps a register, so to speak. He knows every single one of them. God control, plan, solve their problems. Job cannot. Job cannot assist in the growth of their young ones and ensure the continuity of the cycle through the young ones. Job cannot do that. God does. Spotless, flawless. In verses 5 to 12, we do have two animals, and they are there to show God's sovereignty, but man's inability in controlling the habits or the lifestyle of the animal world. So we will separate those two animals, since there are many verses about them. Let's read about the first one, the wild donkey, in verse 5 to 8, and after that we will look at verses 9 to 12, where it talks about the wild ox. Now, you can see in verse 5, you are going to read, there is an onager. That's a special type of wild donkey, so it's about the same thing. Would someone read for us verses 5 to 8 about the wild donkey?
Who sent out the wild donkey free? And who loosed the bonds of the swift donkey, to whom I gave the wilderness for a home and the salt land for his dwelling place? He scorns the tumult of the city. The shoutings of the driver he does not hear. He explores the mountains for his pasture and searches after every green thing.
This is kind of, donkeys are known as domesticated animals. Human beings provide them with pasture to graze and other treatments so that they might serve as beasts of burden. The idea that they could survive on their own is still foreign to most people. Yet they do. And who controls that kind of lifestyle for a wild donkey? Who does? Who helps them survive in the wild? God does, not Job. And then here's the opposite contrast. Here's an animal that is domesticated and that God allows to be wild and survive. And isn't that the one we could have been more useful to human beings if it could be domesticated, but it cannot? That's the wild ox in verses 9 to 12. Let's read that, please.
Will the wild ox be willing to serve you? Will he bed by your manger? Can you bind the wild ox in the furrow with ropes, or will he plow the valleys behind you? Will you trust him because his strength is great, or will you leave your labor to him? Will you trust him to bring home your grain and gather it to your threshing floor?
Well, the donkeys are domesticated animals that we cannot conceive as living in the wild. The wild ox, by contrast, is a wild animal that does not submit to domestication. And either one, no problem for God to give them their habits and their lifestyle. The wild ox will not be willing to serve Job. It will not abide in a manger as a donkey would do. He will not bear implements to plow the field as donkeys might accept to do. And Job had many of them, many donkeys. Though it may be more powerful than a donkey, it will not be tamed. You cannot trust it to behave as you expect. It will not carry your livelihood for you in a safe and predictable manner to your storage or your home. You will lose it. You won't trust it. So as we look at this, these two animals stand in contrast to each other. Who established and controlled their habits or lifestyle? God did, not Job, not you, not I. And God did it according to his wise and holy counsel, without fanfare, without need of help, without expectation of counsel from someone else, or without any mistake ever. He just does it because that's the way he purposed to do it. And when we get to verses 13 to 18, that is going to be a contrast to verses 19 to 25. But in verses 13 to 18, we have one animal that stands there to show God's sovereignty and man's inability in defining the peculiarities of the animal world. The peculiar stupidity of the ostrich. Oh, man. You think, man, do we need this one? God did it. Can someone read verses 13 to 18 for us?
The ostrich's wings flap joyously with the pinion and the plumage of love, for she abandons her eggs to the earth and warms them in the dust. And she forgets that a foot may crush them or that a wild beast may trample them. She treats her young cruelly as if they were not hers. Though her labor be in vain, she is unconcerned. Because God has made her forget wisdom and has not given her a share of understanding, When she lifts herself on high, she laughs at the horse and his rider.
So the ostrich lays eggs in a nonchalant manner. Same nest sometime has eggs for many ostriches. And sometimes that one nest is so full that one ostrich comes to lay eggs and says, oh, well, no problem. Right next, put it right there in the sand. Not even one thought of what might happen, the risks and dangers associated with such absent-mindedness. She neglects or abuses her little ones as if they belong to her enemies, unconcerned of their fate and oblivious to the travail that she went through to produce them. And she said, well, man, she doesn't even think about that. I suffered a lot for this one. She is odd or even bizarre. She has wings like the stork, but cannot fly. Pop, 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 pop. Nothing happens. She is tall, up to 8 feet, reminding us of the giraffe, but she cannot dominate, living with her head almost in the sand. I mean, at a speed of 40 miles an hour, she is faster than a horse, but cannot reach any objective. She's going. If you have seen the film, The God Must Be Crazy, then you know how an ostrich runs. God made her this way, according to her, to his wise and holy counsel. Out of the same clay, God can make a vase of honorable service and another vase that will be for private, dirty services. The mention of the horse in verse 18 announces the contrast that God will make between the ostrich, verses 13 to 18, and the war horse in verses 19 to 25. At 8 feet in height, the ostrich may be taller than the horse. At 40 miles an hour in speed, the ostrich may be faster than a horse. But what a contrast between the stupidity of the ostrich and the sophistication of the war horse. Listen about the war horse in verses 19 to 25.
Have you clothed his neck with thunder? Can you frighten him like a locust? His majesty snorting strikes terror. He paws in the valley and rejoices in his strength. He gallops into the clash of arms. He mocks at fear and is not frightened, nor does he turn back from the sword. The quiver rattles against him, the glittering spear and javelin. He devours the distance with fierceness and rage, nor does he come to a halt because of the trumpet has sounded. At the blast of the trumpet, he says, aha. He smells the battle from afar, the thunder of captains and shouting.
So God's sovereignty, by contrast to men's inability in the sophistication of the animal world. Some animals are so sophisticated, and a horse is representative of them. By contrast to the ostrich, who is known to being dumb and stupid, the animal world contains some animals that are extremely sophisticated and structured in their behaviors and lifestyle. And the war horse is representative of that. Verses 19 to 20 speaks of his power and elegance and terror. I mean, they use horses to dispel crowds, for example. I mean, that's not the way they do. I cannot. that doesn't bring terror. So verses 21 to 22 speaks about their skill, their fearlessness, and their bravery. And verses 23 to 25, there we read about their sense of purpose, dedication, and ardor in going forward. I mean, God has made certain animals dumb and stupid, and God has made other animals sophisticated and structured. Their habits or lifestyle can be completely the opposite. They can be an irony of the universe, yet they all fulfill the purpose of his providence, just like every human being does. Those who are born healthy, those who are not born healthy. Whether completely normal or not, whether they be sick or healthy, smart or simple, whether they be tall or short, whether they be rich or poor, whether they be black or white, and so on. God has made every single one in his providence. It is all under God's control, according to his and only wise and holy counsel. In the sixth part of that speech, God shows his sovereignty but man's inability in programming the mobility strategies of the animal world. Do you know those animals, they have a way of planning things? Look at those in verses 26 to 30.
Does the hawk fly by your wisdom and spread its wings toward the south? Does the eagle mount up at your command and make its nest on high? On the rock it dwells and resides, on the crag of the rock and the stronghold. From there it spies out the prey, its eyes observe from afar. Its young ones suck up blood, and where the slain are, there it is.
From the ostrich that has wings but cannot fly, we come to animals who are master flyers, the ox and the eagles. Verse 26 talk about the ox. Job does not provide neither the boot camp training nor the GPS tools to the hawks for them to migrate toward the south in line, in order, and reach their destination on time. God does. And in verses 26 to 2030, Job does not train, nor does he select the ideal spot for the eagle to establish her family on that perch for protection of her young ones, and at the same time to use that place as an observation deck to detect her prey. She is very strategic in all her moves. The location, the observation, the intelligence gathering, the planning of attack in her next move, the supply for her chicks, and even some potential rationing of supply when she felt that it took me too long to find this food, therefore I don't know when I'll find the next piece of supply. God does all that, not Job. So as we conclude this evening, there are four takeaways that we should have, I believe. First of all is the tone of what we just read. These questions are not asked out of meanness. Very often I hear preachers look, hey, Job, God got her. Hey, who are you, big mouth? That's not the way God is talking. Those questions are graciously, they are there to graciously enlighten the beloved, but still yet misconceived servant. Those questions are in tone similar to the loving mother asking questions to a toddler who thinks that he has this. He knows it. He has figured it out. And I can see some parents back there who are looking at each other. And the mother said, really? Where did you find it? How does it work? Where does it go? Ah, and then you find a toddler starting making it up. That's the tone we have here. God does not tolerate us, but at the same time, he's not mean. When we have those prayers and we are in those kind of tragedies that I have given examples at the beginning, he is still gracious. but he is still going to challenge us, though in a gracious manner. The second thing as a takeaway is the theological sphere in which we have this. In theology, the concept of God's operation of the world is called providence. We talk about providence in the past in our preaching, but it behooves us to remind us, what do we mean from the Bible as providence? Here's one of my favorite theologians' definition. He says this: by providence, we mean the continuing action of God by which he preserves in existence the creation which he has brought into being. He preserves it and guides it. The second thing, he guides it to his intended purpose for it. So in providence, God will preserve Hans Bernard that he has made, but he is also going to control the circumstances and everything to guide Hans Bernard for the purpose he has made Hans Bernard. Providence, therefore, has two aspects to it. One is, and I quote again, God's work of preserving his creation in existence by maintaining and sustaining it. And this is generally called preservation or sustenance. The other aspect of providence is God's activity in guiding and directing the course of events to fulfill the purposes which he has in mind. This is term government or providence proper. So when Job contended, or when we ask question, when we question God's operation of our lives, we are questioning God's ability and his purpose. We are saying, you are fired in operating this world. I have a better way of doing it, and I am commanding you to change it. And God graciously asked us questions and said, where were you and who are you? We are questioning his providence, keeping us in existence through his maintenance and sustenance. And on the other hand, the purposes that in his wise and holy counsel he has for us. He has a purpose for each one of you. It is his purpose, not yours. As tough, brother or sister, it can be. He makes no mistake. And it's a third thing. The irony, as we read those questions, is that these tasks and the potential to fulfill these tasks were in many ways, not always, in many ways granted to man at creation. This is a job that God gave to man. Listen to Genesis chapter 1, verses 25 to 29. And God made the beasts of the earth, each according to its kind, cattle according to its kind, and everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God is going to establish a CEO to operate the company that he just created. Then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So when God was asking Job, okay, I gave you guys a job at the beginning, and you are asking me that I'm not doing my job. What about this? How did you do? So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female. He created them. Amen? And God blessed him, blessed them. And God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. And God said, see, I have given you every herb inanimate, every herb that yields seed, which is on the face of all the earth, and then and every tree whose fruit yields seed, to you it shall be for food. So in a sense, Job was the relic in his own duty. Job wasn't capable in his own environment and activities. The farming blessings that Job has had have all been from the Lord before he lost it. In his daily grace, God has given those things. God has never been mean to Job. He has always been good where Job has been incapable and limited. Always. Job is not the center of the universe. The universe does not rise up or fall on whether Job gets up from the right or the wrong side of the bed. God operates things in his providence according to his wise and holy counsel to fulfill his purpose, including our lives, brothers and sisters. And here's the fourth and last takeaway. The operation of the world functions on extremely sophisticated and wise plan. There is no CEO on Wall Street who is qualified enough to run the world, especially those who are on that White House on Pennsylvania Avenue. Man. God has set the world and developed the operating system to manage its function. Man cannot fathom the depth and the breadth of that wisdom. Any questioning of God's management must be out of words that obscure God's counsel. Never enlightening God's counsel. Man cannot enlighten God. Man cannot come up with a better way. There is no better way. As we sung, his ways are perfect. His ways are perfect. So, brothers and sisters, very, very tough things happen to good people who appear to be innocent. And what God is telling Job is that when we use the word why, we are asking the wrong question. The question is not why does God do it like this? The question should always be, what should I do, Lord, since you are doing it like this? When you ask that question, you hear prayers that come like this. Oh, give me strength to go through this. I am at the end of my rope. I remember one of those times in the challenge, my wife and me. I remember that time. Her dear mother had 5 children, 2 set of twins and her sister in between. The first set of twins was her and the boy, and that boy died, 3 months? 18 days after, she survived. Had another daughter, my wife's sister, had another set of twins. The first one died at 3 months. The second one was 12 years old, and they were in the public transportation going on vacation, had an accident that almost took her life, but took the life of the boy. I didn't grow up with my parents. And since my childhood, I kept praying, Lord, would you give me a son so that I may be to him the father I never had. Our second child was a boy. And he died just a few days before delivery. And I remember my mother-in-law coming to our house, and a taxi dropped her, and she went to the gate repeating, God, God, why can't we have a boy in our family? And I remember my wife and me praying at the hospital and saying, God, it hurts. And I say, God, please don't waste it. If I'm paying that much, make the most you can be out of it. Give it a big dividend, big spiritual dividend. I don't know what God has done through this. But what I'm saying is this. When you ask the question, what should I do, Lord, since things are this way, your prayers change. Your aspirations change. Somehow strength comes from nowhere. Changing in your life, in your children, in your church, in your parents, in your family. What should I do, Lord, since things are the way they are? Let us pray. Father, you have impressed my heart to talk this way to my brothers and sisters, and some of them may be going through some things that I cannot even explain. And I pray, Father, that your goodness and mercy will always be with them abundantly. I know you never fail. God never fails. But I pray, Father, they will experience it through the hard times so that your providence will always be out of graciousness and mercy. Magnify your name, we pray. In Jesus Christ's name.